7. Have your steak and eat it, too. 1. Eating animals. When Jonathan Safran Foer was 9 years old, he asked his babysitter why she wasn't eating the chicken that he and his brother Frank were having. "I don't want to hurt anything," she said. "Hurt anything?" Foer asked. "You know that chicken is chicken, right?" she said. "I put down my fork," Foer wrote in his 2009 vegetarian memoir manifesto, Eating Animals. What about his brother? Frank finished the meal and is probably eating a chicken as I type these words. Many of us who eventually became vegetarians have similar stories. When I was 4 years old, I told my parents I wouldn't eat pigs because I had just met one. The environmental case for vegetarianism appears to have only grown stronger. In 2019, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, IPCC, published a special report on food and agriculture. Scientists say that we must immediately change the way we manage land, produce food, and eat less meat in order to halt the climate crisis, reported CNN. Scientists expect the demand for food to outpace population growth by more than 50% by 2050. If that's the case, then Americans and Europeans need to reduce consumption of beef and pork by 40% and 22%, respectively, they said, in order to feed 10 billion people. "We don't want to tell people what to eat," said the scientist, who co-chaired the IPCC's Working Group on Climate Impacts and Adaptation. "But it would indeed be beneficial for both climate and human health if people in many rich countries consumed less meat, and if politics would create appropriate incentives to that effect. We need a radical transformation, not incremental shifts, towards a global land use and food system that serves our climate needs," said the head of an environmental philanthropy. It's really exciting that the IPCC is getting such a strong message across. If everyone followed a vegan diet, which excludes not only meat, but also eggs and dairy products, land-based emissions could be cut by 70% by 2050, said IPCC. To reduce the consumption of meat, the best strategy is to make it more expensive, say some environmental groups. One estimated that the cost of beef and dairy to consumers would increase by 30% if it were to account for its climate impacts. Eating less meat would not only benefit the climate but also human health, say many scientists. In 2018, according to the U.S. Department of Agriculture, Americans were expected to eat a record 222 pounds of red meat and poultry, up from 217 pounds per consumer in 2017. In fact, Americans were consuming about 10 ounces of meat per day, which is about twice as much as government nutritionists recommend. Eating less red meat might be good for the planet, but it could also help your health, reported CNN. Earlier research has found that eating red meat is tied to increased risks of diabetes, heart diseases, and some cancers. In response to the science linking meat to climate change, some climate activists, including Greta Thunberg, have sworn off meat and have persuaded their parents to become vegetarian and even vegan. By reducing meat consumption, ending industrial agriculture, and committing ourselves to free-range, grass-fed pasture meat, say many scientists and environmentalists, we will return more of Earth to nature. But would we really? 2. The Meat-Free Nothing Burger. Even though I have been researching and writing on climate and energy policy for nearly 2 decades, I have failed to recognize that the headline number in the IPCC's 2019 report, 70% reduction in emissions by 2050, referred only to agricultural emissions, which comprise a fraction of total greenhouse emissions. I suspect many others similarly thought the number was referring to all emissions. One study found that converting to vegetarianism might reduce diet-related personal energy use by 16% and greenhouse gas emissions by 20%, but total personal energy use by just 2%, and total greenhouse gas emissions by 4%. As such, were IPCC's most extreme scenario of global veganism to be realized, in which by 2050 humans completely cease to consume animal products and all livestock land is reforested, total carbon emissions would decline by just 10%. Another study found that if every American reduced her or his meat consumption by one quarter, greenhouse emissions would be reduced by just 1%. If every American became vegetarian, U.S. emissions would drop by just 5%. Study after study comes to the same conclusion. One found that for individuals in developed nations, going vegetarian would reduce emissions by just 4.3% on average. And yet another found that if every American went vegan, emissions would decline by just 2.6%. Plant-based diets, researchers find, are cheaper than those that include meat. As a result, people often end up spending their money on things that use energy, like consumer products. This phenomenon is known as the rebound effect. If consumers re-spent their saved income on consumer goods, which require energy, the net energy savings would only be 0.07%, and the net carbon reduction just 2%. It is for that reason that reducing carbon emissions in energy, not food or use of land more broadly, matters most. And energy includes electricity, transportation, cooking and heating, nearly 90% of which globally are fossil fuels. None of this is to suggest that people in rich nations can't be persuaded to change their diets. For example, since the 1970s, Americans and others in developed nations have been eating more chicken and less beef. The global output of chicken meat has grown 14-fold, from 8 metric megatons to 109 metric megatons, between 1961 and 2017. But the thing that makes chicken production environmentally superior to beef production is the very thing for most laments: the higher density of meat production allowed for by factory farming. After visiting a chicken facility, Four writes, "It's hard to get one's head around the magnitude of 33,000 birds in one room." 3. The nature of meat. While meat production is a relatively modest contributor to climate change, it represents humankind's single largest impact on natural landscapes. Today, humans use more than one quarter of Earth's land surface for meat production, and the spread of pasture for cattle and other domesticated animals continues to threaten many endangered species, including mountain gorillas and yellow-eyed penguins. During the last 300 years, an area of forests and grasslands almost as large as North America was converted into pasture, resulting in massive habitat loss and driving the significant declines in wild animal populations. Between 1961 and 2016, pasture land expanded by an area almost the size of Alaska. The good news is that the total amount of land humankind uses to produce meat peaked in the year 2000. Since then, the land dedicated to livestock pasture around the world, according to the Food and Agriculture Organization of the UN, has decreased by more than 540 million square miles, an area 80% as large as Alaska. All of this happened without a vegetarian revolution. Today, just 2-4% of Americans are vegetarian or vegan. About 80% of those who try to become vegetarian or vegan eventually abandon their diet, and more than half do so within the first year. Developed nations like the United States saw the amount of land they use for meat production peak in the 1960s. Developing nations, including India and Brazil, saw their use of land as pasture similarly peak and decline. Part of this is due to the shift from beef to chicken. A gram of protein from beef requires 2 times the energy input in the form of feed as a gram from pork, and 8 times a gram from chicken. But mostly, it is due to efficiency. Between 1925, when the United States started producing chicken indoors, and 2017, breeders cut feeding time by more than half, while more than doubling the weight. Meat production roughly doubled in the United States since the early 1960s, and yet greenhouse gas emissions from livestock declined by 11% during the same period. Throughout eating animals, Four argues that factory farms are far worse for the natural environment than free-range beef. He writes, "If we consumers can limit our desire for pork and poultry to the capacity of the land, a big if, there are no knockdown ecological arguments against free-range farming. But would switching to free-range farming really be better for nature in what Four calls our overpopulated world?" Consider that pasture beef requires 14 to 19 times more land per kilogram than industrial beef, according to a review of 15 studies. The same is true for other inputs, including water. Highly efficient industrial agriculture in rich nations requires less water per output than small farmer agriculture in poor ones. Pasture beef generates 300 to 400% more carbon emissions per kilogram than industrial beef. This difference in emissions comes down to diet and lifespan. Cows raised at industrial farms are typically sent from pastures to feedlots at about 9 months old, and then they are sent to slaughter at 14 to 18 months. Grass-fed cattle spend their entire lives at pasture and aren't slaughtered until between 18 to 24 months of age. Since grass-fed cows gain weight more slowly and live longer, they produce more manure and methane. In addition to their longer lifespans, the roughage-heavy diets typical of organic and pasture farm systems result in cows releasing more methane. These facts combined tell us that the global warming potential of cows fed concentrates is 4 to 28% lower for cows fed roughage. Attempting to move from factory farming to organic free-range farming would require vastly more land and thus destroy the habitat needed by mountain gorillas, yellow-eyed penguins, and other endangered species. Four unwittingly advocates 19th-century farming methods that, if adopted, would require turning wildlife-rich protected areas like Virunga Park into gigantic cattle ranches. Farmers make this point to Four in Eating Animals. You simply can't feed billions of people free-range eggs. It's cheaper to produce an egg in a massive laying barn with caged hens, says one. It's more efficient, and that means it's more sustainable. Do you think family farms are going to sustain a world of 10 billion? 4. Meat equals life. In 2000, a journalist named Nina Teicholz started writing restaurant reviews for a small newspaper in New York. "It didn't have a budget to pay for meals," she says, "so I usually ate whatever the chef decided to send out to me." Teicholz found herself eating foods she had long avoided, such as beef, cream, and foie gras. For 20 years, she had been eating a mostly vegetarian diet. "When the Mediterranean diet was introduced in the 1990s, I added olive oil and extra servings of fish while cutting back on red meat," she says. Avoiding the saturated fats found in animal foods especially seemed like the most obvious measure a person could take for good health. Still, she had struggled to lose stubborn extra weight for 2 years. Even while consuming a recommended diet loaded with vegetables, fruits, and grains, and exercising daily. Then, after eating the high-fat meals chefs were serving her, something strange happened. She lost 10 pounds over 2 months, despite eating animal products high in saturated fat. And Teicholz found she loved eating the high-fat dishes. They were complex and remarkably satisfying, compared to the high-carbohydrate Mediterranean diet she had been following. Around the same time, the magazine Gourmet asked Ty Scholes to write an article about the growing controversy over trans fats, which are made from vegetable oils. But the more she read about the issue, the more I became convinced that the story was far larger and more complex than trans fats. And so she decided to do more research. 9 years later, in 2014, Simon & Schuster published Ty Scholes' best-selling book, The Big Fat Surprise: Why Butter, Meat, and Cheese Belong in a Healthy Diet. She reported on a body of evidence, particularly a series of clinical trials conducted in the 1950s and 1960s, which challenged the nutrition consensus that diets high in animal fats result in heart disease and obesity. The evidence suggested there was either no effect or that diets high in saturated fats might be beneficial. There are now at least 17 systematic reviews looking at the clinical trials, and nearly all conclude that saturated fats have no impact on mortality, she explained. Ty Scholes' book, built on a significant body of research unearthed by science journalist Gary Taubes, whose 2007 book, Good Calories, Bad Calories, was one of the first to challenge the anti-fat conventional wisdom. While writing for Science and the New York Times Magazine in the early 2000s, Taubes unearthed studies finding that a high-fat diet would lead to weight loss and improvements in heart disease risk factors compared to the kind of low-fat, plant-rich diets that the American Heart Association and the U.S. government had been advising us to eat since the 1960s and 1980s, respectively. You had obesity researchers saying that obesity had to be a hormonal regulatory defect for decades before the revelation in the 1960s that insulin was regulating fat accumulation, noted Taubes, which won the researchers the Nobel Prize. One of them said, if insulin regulates fat accumulation, then rather than obesity causing diabetes, wouldn't mild diabetes cause obesity? Yet for decades, the scientific consensus remained that high-fat diets were dangerous. That consensus led many governments to promote a diet high in carbohydrates, low in animal protein, and very low in animal fats. Ty Scholes and Taubes believe the conventional wisdom that a calorie is a calorie, which is known as the energy balance theory, is wrong because our bodies process fats radically different from how they process carbohydrates. When we eat carbohydrates, they believe, the body works to keep the fat locked away in storage. Obesity and diabetes are a result of hormone imbalance caused by eating more carbohydrates than the body can handle, they say. The people who are challenging the orthodoxy were in the minority, but they were by no means fringe scientists. You had the best leading authority on childhood obesity in the mid-20th century and the leading endocrinologist of that era, both making the same argument, notes Taubes. You had British researchers saying that obesity, heart disease, and cancer all appeared in other populations when they switched to Western diets and started eating sugar and refined grains, which would have unique effects on insulin secretion, he explained. And then you had the discovery that metabolic syndrome, which is a cluster of abnormalities, including weight gain and high blood pressure, which affects around half of middle-aged men and women in the U.S., is linked to the carb content of the diet, not to the fat content. This syndrome is directly linked to diabetes and obesity. 5. Death for life. By using fire to cook meat, rather than eating it raw, our pre-human ancestors were able to consume much larger amounts of protein. That, in turn, may have allowed their intestines to grow smaller, since less digestion was required, and their brains to grow bigger, according to the emerging theory of human evolution. Our brains grew so big that pre-humans began delivering their bigger-brained babies prematurely, at 9 months instead of 12 months, like other primates. Mothers carried their premature babies by strapping them to their bodies with animal bladders and skins. Those technologies effectively allowed babies to finish what is sometimes called their fourth trimester outside the womb. The final outcome was the human brain. It demands 2 to 3 times as much energy by mass as the brains of other primates. Around the world, hunter-gatherers as far back as 2 million years ago valued animal fat more than protein or carbohydrates. The reason is obvious. Animal fats contain 2 to 5 times as much energy by mass as protein and 10 to 40 times as much as fruits and vegetables. Those higher densities allowed early humans to gain more energy with less work than carbohydrates. The consumption of meat has always been associated with masculine power, carnality, testosterone, and your sexuality, says Ty Schulz. It fuels strength. It gives you the protein and nutrients you need to be strong. So it's seen as being connected to sexual and masculine desires. As hunter-gatherers settled down, they domesticated animals to grow quickly and efficiently. People primarily domesticated those animals that consumed foods humans could not eat, like ruminants, which have special protozoa in their intestines to digest grasses mammals cannot. Even today, meat remains a key source of energy for most people. "My metabolism needs meat and eggs," says animal welfare expert Temple Grandin. "If I do not eat animal protein, I get lightheaded and have difficulty thinking. I have tried eating a vegan diet and I cannot function on it." I am the same way. During the decade I was vegetarian, I grew tired most afternoons after eating a carb-heavy lunch, no matter how much sleep I got the night before. It was only after eating meat again that I could work through the afternoon without feeling sleepy. Some studies find that vegans and vegetarians are more prone to fatigue, headaches, and dizziness because of the deficiency of vitamin B12 and iron in the absence of red meat. People are vegetarian for many different reasons and in many different ways. Some people are vegetarian for ethical reasons, others for health, others for the environment, and some, like Bernadette, because she can't afford meat. Like many vegetarians, my motivations shifted over time. On the one hand, I wanted to save the rainforests. On the other hand, when people asked about it, I often identified health as the reason, partly because I wanted to avoid the argument that could ensue if I named ethical reasons. My experience is not unusual. Liberals and environmentalists are far more likely than conservatives to become vegetarians. And while women are more likely to become vegetarian than men, both men and women are likelier to become vegetarians as adolescents or young adults than at any other age. "I gave up meat at 14 or 15, said Eric, a professional acquaintance of mine in his mid-40s. "I was in a straight-edge band. You know, straight edge, Fugazi?" I said I did. Fugazi is an influential post-hardcore band from the 1990s. "No girls, no weed, no beer, vegetarian," said Eric. "But it only lasted for 4 weeks because we made friends with a pot dealer and became a ska band. Still, I stuck with vegetarianism because it made my life better." Eric said he is disgusted by the texture of meat. "A chef once told me that my problem is I don't like to grind things. I find a raw tomato is gross. I once cooked a roast and held the roast in my hand and felt disgusted by how it felt like a newborn baby. Even the meatless Impossible Burger, which I ordered, was gross because it reminded me of all the things I hate about meat." For decades, psychologists have been interested in the relationship between vegetarianism and the emotion of disgust. A study of adolescent British girls found that vegetarians associated meat with cruelty, killing, the ingestion of blood, and disgust. "Yeah, the disgust thing," said Eric. "I'm a contamination vegetarian. I won't eat pizza if it's half cheese, half pepperoni, because the cheese side might have been touched by a pepperoni." An Italian team of psychologists recently found vegetarians view meat as the representation of death as a contaminating essence. The theme comes up again and again in vegetarian literature. When we eat factory-farmed meat, we live, literally, on tortured flesh, writes Four. Increasingly, that tortured flesh is becoming our own. In 1989, when I arrived at college, animal rights activists were eager to share horrifying videos of factory farming conditions. We know if someone offers to show us a film on how our meat is produced, writes Four, it will be a horror film. It was videos like those, made and distributed by groups like PETA before the internet, that led people like me, my college girlfriend, and many of the people around us at our Quaker College in Indiana to stop eating meat in the late 1980s. And it is videos like those that continue to motivate young people to go vegetarian. I became a vegetarian in fifth grade, my colleague Madison, who turned 25 in 2020, said. My debate topic was vegetarianism, and my goal was to persuade the class. I watched a bunch of videos on animal cruelty and animal farming, and it really disturbed me. It was the main thing for me. 12 years went by, and I didn't feel I needed meat. By the 1990s, PETA had learned the power of going after big brands. It distributed videos showing McDonald's supplier farms abusing animals. In 1999, McDonald's hired the animal welfare expert Temple Grandin to audit the farms of its suppliers. She was appalled by what she found. "It was terrible," she said. "Broken, stunning equipment, yelling and screaming and hitting cattle, poking them repeatedly with electric prods." Grandin was already a leading authority on humane treatment of animals. In the 1970s, she designed equipment for slaughterhouses that reduced stress for cattle going to slaughter. In 1993, she edited a textbook on how to best handle livestock. Grandin said it was easy for her to imagine how cows felt because she was autistic. "My nervous system was hypervigilant. Any little thing out of place, like a water stain on the ceiling, would set off a panic reaction, and cattle are scared of the same thing." Scientists define autism as a developmental disorder, one that involves a difficulty in communicating and interacting socially, and thinking and behaving in ways that are restricted and repetitive. But Grandin found her autism also gave her unique insights. It made her sensitive in the same way animals, including beef cows, are to noises and visual stimulation. "Animals don't think in language," she said. "They think in pictures." In Eating Animals, Four argues that it's plainly wrong to eat factory-farmed pork, poultry, or sea animals. With feedlot-raised beef, the industry offends me less, and 100% pasture-raised beef, setting aside the issue of slaughter for a moment, is probably the least troubling of all meats. But Grandin didn't find that cattle needed to be raised on grass-fed pastures in order to be calm. Rather, she found that what cattle most wanted was cleanliness and predictability. "Keeping the pens dry and keeping cattle clean, that's really important," she said. Grandin discovered that cows were being made nervous by visual and auditory surprises that had until then been ignored, such as swinging chains and loud, high-pitched banging. Things that felt out of the ordinary signaled danger to cows and stressed them. Because ethical reasons alone were not sufficient to convince the manager to change the practices, Grandin explained, she had to find things that resulted in both more humane treatment and lower costs. She and a student soon proved that cattle that remained calm during handling had higher weight gains than stressed cattle. Stress hormones damage meat, which is another reason it is in the farmer's interest to reduce his livestock's fear. Grandin's audits eventually made more than 50 farms more humane and more efficient. She didn't eliminate all problems. In 2009, 10 years after she began her audits, Grandin found that 25% of all beef and chicken slaughterhouses should not have passed inspection. Even so, she had made progress. "Compared to the bad old days, it's drastically improved, and I mean drastically," said Grandin. 6. The Nature of Death. One of the questions people frequently ask vegetarians is why it would be unethical for humans to eat animals, but not unethical for animals to eat animals. Eating meat may be natural, and most humans may find it acceptable. Humans certainly have been doing it for a very long time, but these are not moral arguments, says a PETA spokesperson. In fact, the entirety of human society and moral progress represents an explicit transcendence of what's natural. As a college undergraduate attempting to make sense of my vegetarianism, I remember finding this argument persuasive. We prohibit rape and murder not because they are unnatural, but because they are immoral. And yet many seemingly hard moral arguments for animal rights are, in reality, animal welfare arguments. Take the oft-used comparison of slavery and meat. The consequence of deciding slavery is immoral is making people free. The consequence of deciding meat is immoral is not making animals free. It's not making animals. Is it more ethical to never create life than to create it and take it away? Ford, to his credit, doesn't claim there is a single right or wrong answer to that question. Instead, he returns to the issue of cruelty. Ford quotes Grandin's report on factory farms from when she first started doing her work. Grandin documented deliberate acts of cruelty, notes Ford. Deliberate acts, he emphasizes, occurring on a regular basis. But one can find many more acts of cruelty in nature than in the slaughterhouse. Out on a western ranch, I saw a calf that had its hide ripped completely off on one side by coyotes, writes Grandin. It was still alive, and the rancher had to shoot it to put it out of its misery. If I had a choice, going to a well-run modern slaughter plant would be preferable to being ripped apart alive. From the perspective of the calf, the deliberate, regulated, and painlessness of modern slaughterhouses may be better than the random, painful, and instinctual cruelty of nature. Either way, the ethics of meat are unavoidably subjective. They aren't something anyone should be dogmatic about. And yet, some vegetarian journalists, activists, and scientists have sought to demand that others follow their personal preferences in the name of environmental protection, particularly as it relates to climate change, and often in stealth fashion. 90% of the climate scientists and environmentalists I've met are vegetarian, Ford told Huffington Post in 2019. And the ones that aren't eat very little meat. It's something that seems to go without saying. I wish they would talk about it more, but it's been heartening to see. But it may be that scientists don't talk about it because people would rightly wonder if their vegetarianism biased their scientific objectivity. In my research, I kept coming across cases of vegetarian activists who kept their motives hidden. A friend of mine had an experience a few years ago where two young guys came and asked if they could take footage for a documentary about farm life, a farmer told Four. Seemed like nice guys, but then they edited it to make it look like the birds were being abused. Things were taken out of context. When I started this research in the 1990s and was looking at dietary salt, said science journalist Gary Taubes, I interviewed a Harvard nutritionist who told me about going into nutrition science as a vegetarian and student at Berkeley in the late 60s, so he could demonstrate to people that his way of eating was correct. Ford notes that PETA activists used the former head of the IPCC, Rajendra Pachauri, as a scientific authority on climate change because he argues that vegetarianism is the diet that everyone in the developed world should consume, purely on environmental grounds. Sometimes Ford condemns animal farming for reasons that appear to have more to do with anti-capitalist ideology than the environment. The economics of the market inevitably leads toward instability, he writes. Such a logic leads Ford to attack farmed salmon as worse for the environment than wild salmon, even though, as we saw, not only are farmed salmon of equal nutritional value as wild salmon, they substitute for wild salmon and open up the potential of reducing overfishing, one of humankind's largest and least discussed impacts on wild animals. I have to say there is part of me that envies the moral clarity of the vegetarian, writes University of California journalism professor Michael Pollan in a passage from his 2007 book, The Omnivore's Dilemma. Yet part of me pities him, too. Dreams of innocence are just that. They usually depend on a denial of reality that can be its own form of hubris. The trouble with dogmatic vegetarianism is the same as with dogmatic environmentalism. It ends up alienating the very people needed for improving conditions for animals and reducing the environmental impact of farming. In the 80s, the industry tried to communicate with animal groups, and we got burned real bad, a farmer told Four. So the turkey community decided there would be no more of it. We put up a wall, and that was the end. We don't talk, don't let people onto the farms. Standard operating procedure. PETA doesn't want to talk about farming, they want to end farming. They have absolutely no idea how the world actually works. Taubes and Tyschultz seemed partly vindicated in late summer 2019 when the British Medical Journal published a review of the nutritional science that upended decades of orthodoxy. Diets that replace saturated fat with polyunsaturated fat do not convincingly reduce cardiovascular events or mortality, it found. The authors said, "We must consider that the diet-heart hypothesis is invalid or requires modification." One of the authors had coined the term the French paradox to explain why the French could eat so much fatty food without getting fat. The BMJ article and the science collected by Taubes and Tyschultz suggested it was not a paradox after all. 1 month later, just as vegetarian critics were starting to respond to the BMJ, the prestigious U.S. scientific journal Annals of Internal Medicine published two of the largest and more rigorous studies of meat consumption to date. They found that any negative health impacts of eating red meat, to the extent they exist at all, would be too small to matter. "It should certainly not be interpreted as a license to eat as much meat as you like," wrote a medical columnist for the New York Times, a newspaper that for 50 years has advocated diets low in saturated fats. But the scope of the work is expansive, and it confirms prior work that the evidence against meat isn't nearly as solid as many seem to believe. The pro-carb, anti-fat crusade turned out to be as bad for the environment as it was for people. By making pigs less fatty, breeders made them less efficient in converting feed into body mass. More grain and thus more land was required under the low-fat regime than would have been required under a normal fat one. Much of the public's concerns about meat have thus been misplaced. Consumers continue to express anxiety over things like the use of growth-promoting hormones in beef, even though the Food and Drug Administration, World Health Organization, and Food and Agriculture Organization have all concluded that meat produced with them is safe for human consumption. The evidence suggests we should have been more concerned by the absence of fat in our meat than by the use of hormones in its production. 7. Don't eat wild meat. The hunting and consumption of wild game remains one of the primary causes of the decline of wild animals in poor and developing nations. Recall that the number of wild animals in the world declined by half in the 50 years between 1960 and 2010. Forests in Africa, Asia, and Latin America that were recently populated with wild animals suffer today from empty forest syndrome due to the killing of wild animals. More than 50% of all mammal taxa, units for classifying organisms, in the Congo Basin are being hunted unsustainably. Poor nations like the Congo desperately need to both provide more protein to their people and increase the productivity of meat production to take pressure off the habitat of mountain gorillas, yellow-eyed penguins, and other endangered species. While people in developing countries increased their per capita meat consumption from 10 kilograms per year to 26 kilograms between 1964 to 1999, people in the Congo and other sub-Saharan African nations experienced no change in per capita meat consumption. When I asked Bernadette how often she and her family ate meat, she sighed wistfully and said, "Maybe once a year at Christmas." While the people of the Congo do not eat mountain gorillas, they still kill and eat an astonishing 2.2 million tons of wild animals every year because they lack cheap domesticated meat. Creating cheap and easily obtainable substitutes in the form of domesticated meat should thus be a high priority for conservationists. Reducing the amount of land required for meat production will allow for more land for people and wildlife. In some parts of eastern Congo, there have been efforts to introduce alternatives, like fish farms, to reduce bushmeat consumption, the primatologist Annette Lanyau told me. Although people were happy to have cabbages and carrots on their plates, the only commodity they had that was valuable enough to transport and that they could sell so that they could have cash was meat. They could smoke and dry the meat, and it could be transported long distances to urban centers. The most efficient meat production in North America requires 20 times less land than the most efficient meat production in Africa. Replacing wild animal meat with modern meats like chicken, pork, and beef would require less than 1% of the total land use globally for farming. The technical requirements for creating what experts call the livestock revolution are straightforward. Farmers need to improve breeding of animals, their diet, and the productivity of grasses for foraging. Increasing meat production must go hand in hand with increasing agricultural yields to improve and increase feed. In northern Argentina, farmers were able to reduce the amount of land used for cattle ranching by 99.7%. by replacing grass-fed beef with modern industrial production. We must change our thinking, too. Just as we overcame our preference for authentic furs, ivory, and tortoiseshell, we must retrain our preferences toward domesticated meats and away from wild meats, including fish, for wild animals once again to flourish. 8. Beyond Food and Evil. Whatever its psychological origins, vegetarianism appears to stem less from a rational consideration of the evidence than an emotional rejection of killing animals, something Fore acknowledges. Food is never simply a calculation about which diet uses the least water or causes the least suffering. Indeed, when I returned to meat eating, it was an almost entirely instinctual, not intellectual decision. I hadn't spent any time reading about or discussing the ethical questions. My wife was pregnant and cooking filet mignon. It smelled amazing, and so I ate some. Others rationalize their carnivorous desire. When I moved to the Bay, I was aware of its reputation as an incredible place for food and felt that I would be missing out because of the limits I put on myself, said my colleague Madison. I thought, seafood is clearly different, ethically, and so I'll eat seafood. But then I went to Paris and accidentally tried pâté, and I was like, forget it. But doesn't the act of killing animals still bother you? I asked. Yes, it does, she said. I try not to think about it. But you must have decided it was okay ethically, I asked. As I've grown up, things don't seem as black and white as they did when I was a kid, she said. When I learned that it wasn't having the impact I thought on combating climate change, I decided it wasn't worth it. If you're not actually helping the planet, the calculation definitely changes. Besides, now I more clearly see a separation between humans and animals. Killing a chicken is not the same as murdering a human. There's an important difference there. Fore recognizes that. And even on the fundamental question of whether it is ethical or unethical to eat animals, Fore accepts that there is not a single moral answer that is true for all of us, concluding, if it were unhealthy to stop eating animals, that might be a reason not to be vegetarian. Of course, there are circumstances I can conjure under which I would eat meat. There are even circumstances under which I would eat a dog. But these are circumstances I'm unlikely to encounter. As such, we are left simply with personal preference, and around the world, most people prefer to eat meat. Even most vegetarians, it turns out, aren't actually vegetarians. A majority of vegetarians in Western countries tell researchers that they eat fish, chicken, and even red meat on occasion. Even after Four and his wife made vows of vegetarianism the same week they got engaged to be married, we did occasionally eat burgers and chicken soup and smoked salmon and tuna steaks, but only every now and then, only whenever we felt like it. Four is at his best when he embraces a more empathetic position. The question of eating animals, he writes, is ultimately driven by our intuitions about what it means to reach an ideal we have named, perhaps incorrectly, being human. So too is PETA. As Dr. Grandin has shown us, said PETA's founder, Ingrid Newkirk, giving a little comfort and relief to animals who will be in those cages their whole lives is worth fighting for, even as some of us are demanding that those cages be emptied. In the end, Four wants to be read as an individual telling his story, not as a moralizer. My decision not to eat animals is necessary for me, but it is also limited and personal, says Four. It is a commitment made within the context of my life, not anyone else's.